Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and folks, it's all about constitutional compliance. If you have your those who we call government, your public servants, your representatives, if they're in full compliance of the Constitution, then you don't have any problems from government. They're not taking your property from you. They're not overtaxing you. They're not, you know, sending your kids off to war, at least in the way that we've now become accustomed to being involved in dictating, you know, regimes and so forth. Now, it doesn't mean that they're, you know, we're at the age of the fruition of the war that has been cast upon the world by Satan, because Islam has declared this war back into the 7th century when Islam was established. They basically declared war against the world, that the whole world must be submissive and submit to Islam. And so even though there's no, hey, they've officially declared war every day, that was declared, and we're still facing this. And under the guise of all of this is why we're going to be leading right into the times and the prophecies of the Bible. But you don't come here for me to basically pontificate. I am only here to provide you with the truth and knowledge regarding the Constitution, how limited and defined it is, and how it has been subverted, which is why we're going out of our way this year to literally dive into the Federalist Papers that Madison created to subvert the Constitution. He wasn't creating this long-term argument going back and forth between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. This was something that he was writing and tucking in to have the jurist, his jurist, his friend, his protege, John Marshall, go into the Supreme Court and over time elevate the Federalist Papers over all things constitutional, over the ratification debates as well as over the notes of the Constitution, because he knew that what he provided in there would empower the judiciary to take over our government. This is why we have a judiciary form of government. I mean, there's people today right now that are being very defensive about this democracy that we have. Yeah, but we're more of a judiciary form of government than a democracy, because even the elections go in and the laws of our representatives, all of these things are still scrutinized. When it comes down to who has the ultimate control, we the people have the ultimate control, but the courts have seized that. When I say we the people, our representatives in our Republican form of government, that's where the control is supposed to be in our form of government. But enough about that. Welcome back, Sean. And I'm chomping at the bit to move forward. If you're ready, we kind of left off, folks, with Appendix D. Actually, I call it Appendix D because that's where I've isolated these. So in the forthcoming article, you can go straight to Appendix D. This is where all the highlights will be for you. And we are starting off with Federalist Paper number 82? No, 81. 81, my mistake. And so welcome back, Sean.
Good to be here, sir. Thank you.
No problem. And so again, to the people of the state of New York, again, right there, the Federalist Papers are aimed to one state only. The arguments of what they were trying to say, what they were trying to make, was not relevant to the rest of the nation. Just a dialogue, but that's all this was an editorial dialogue with people of the state of New York, where they were asking questions and so forth, but this was done in a editorial through the newspapers, instead of in a formal, delegated, you know, we voted for these people to choose for us and these people to argue for us to go debate the Constitution. Hamilton just created an open debate using the newspapers, and there's nothing official about that. So how these things became formalized as the guide to understanding the Constitution to this day eludes me. Apparently, the establishment of academic standards and legal standards were so subjective back then that they got away with using newspaper articles to determine, because it's, technically this is all hearsay. So actually, let me start with this, because hopefully you'll give me the latitude on this and help me out if I'm wrong. For academic standards, a primary source document is a document that has been spawned from the event itself. In other words, an academic source document of the Constitutional Convention would either be the secretary's notes on that convention or anybody else that was in the convention that took notes at that time. And if you look at Max Farland's, I think I'm mispronouncing his name because I'm bad with names, but he consolidated all of the different notes from the different quasi-scribes, like Yates was supposedly one, and there was only like 2 or 3 days where he wrote notes. And those 2 or 3 days he wrote notes were very targeted on ideas that he wanted to use to attack Madison with. And so this was in the early 1800s when these came out. So Farland basically makes the assertion that he thinks they're suspect because they would have came out sooner, like 1790, as his notes. Everybody knew that Madison had notes in 1790. Everybody knew that, you know, the secretary wrote notes and that there were a couple of other people that wrote notes on, you know, given days or what have you. But Madison was the most diligent. Nevertheless, those right there, those notes are primary source documents because they're there capturing it. And as a matter of fact, at the end of the convention, there was a review of the notes that Jackson, I think it was William Jackson, took. I think that's the name of the secretary. They actually reviewed them, and they actually had to call William Jackson back in to make a couple of edits to correct it. And he had to sign those corrections so that it was more accurate. Because having the accuracy to the report of the event was critical to them. So that's why those notes were literally considered the primary source documents on the Constitutional Convention. Bar none. Everybody's little letters home and everybody's commentaries in the papers or what have you, such as the Federalist Papers, those are not primary source documents. Those are a person, and in this particular case, a pseudonym of a person, because the Federalist Papers seem to be just one person, Publius, when in fact, the Federalist Papers were John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison. So as we look at what they were, it was all hearsay. They were just basically stating what they interpreted came out in this Constitution from the convention. They weren't identifying who they were. They weren't identifying any of the facts or citing the notes on the Constitutional Convention. What they were doing was they were just editorializing. So technically, in a court of law, help me out, Sean, that would qualify as hearsay.
Correct, sir.
So how is it that hearsay becomes a legal standing for understanding the law or understanding something significant as our supreme law of the land?
It would not.
It would not. But here's the real thing. If you examine, because the Constitution has been sold, and actually if you look at the essence of the Constitution, we give you all of these, the evidence. The framers looked and understood and explained that the Constitution is nothing but a compact. It is a contract of multiple parties, thus a compact. Therefore, the primary source document for the Constitution is not the notes on the convention. The notes on the convention is only the primary source document of the event of the Constitutional Convention. Now we're looking at the actual compact itself. If you look at what the primary source document of a contract is, it is the ratification process. because the ratification process is where the contract in itself is argued and debated line by line so that it is clarified what it actually means. Therefore, when you actually look up, you know, what is the academic primary source document of a contract or a compact, the answer in AI will give you this, that the ratification by the parties to the compact or by the parties to the contract is the legal tending, you know, understanding of that document itself, as well as the document. So the Constitution and the ratification debates, and the ratification debates are really where you get the understanding of it, but they both stand together as primary source documents. That's it. Not the Federalist Papers. Not the letters home to, you know, give the kids a good hug or kick them in the pants and tell them when I get home they're going to get what for if they don't start minding you, sweetheart. You know, that type of stuff. So the point is that everything else is just hearsay. And interestingly enough, when you look at the way the framers were educated, they were educated by primary source documents. They were not educated by editorials. Now, there were editorials such as Montesquieu, and there were other editorials such as Vattel, but the way those editorials were done, they were so comprehensive, like Vattel on the law, or Montesquieu, the laws of nations. When we look at those documents, they were basically like primary source documents. You could take that and the laws of nations, the document itself, the laws of nations, and you go, wow, okay, now we understand. The law itself, I think it was Vattel did the laws of nations, forgive me, and it was Bastiat or something like that, did the law. And that was more of a law on, I think, the law of France, something like that. But he dives into these concepts of the law, which, you know, are insightful. They're insightful for us in America to look back at, you know, how did we evolve into this state of governing law and so forth. Blackstone, forgive me for this little oration on the history and the importance of primary source documents and how we've basically obfuscated the real truth in accepting primary source documents that are not our primary source documents, such as Blackstone, because Blackstone is the next big standard for our legal system. Blackstone's commentaries on the law was strictly his commentaries on the monarchical theocracy of Britain. How is his document, how is that book and the volumes of books he wrote on this, his commentaries, how does that have anything to do with our legal system and our government at all? And yet, if you ask anybody that is the operators of our law, big, huge air quotes here, if you look at the operators of our law, well, they're going to cite Blackstone, but Blackstone said this, and Blackstone said that. He had no clue about our Constitution and our Republican form of government and how the shift was literally shifted away from the Bible towards this document that literally empowered government in such a minute way that it literally created a land of freedom and liberty where we would have a free market system, a free market economy, a free market religion, and a free market of worship, something that was never available to Europe. They had control over their religions. Not here. They had control over what you were going to make, what you were going to sell. Not here. We were the land of liberty. This was a whole new paradigm, and I'm here to tell you Blackstone didn't get it. He may have nailed it on the head when it comes to the monarchical theocracy, but what he provided does not even shine a light on our legal system. Even our common law shifted, because under the common law of Britain, and as a matter of fact, many of the states declared common law of Britain to be placed upon them, But they couldn't, because it would be in a direct violation of the Constitution, because the Constitution declares it is the supreme law of the land. And in Washington State, in 1851, when Washington State declared that the common law of Britain would be the law of the territory of Washington and the state that forth comes out of it, that right there asserted something that was actually unconstitutional, that the Bible of England, the King James Version, would be the supreme law of the land. Folks, right, wrong, or indifferent, when you actually have, and history proves this, when you actually allow zealots, religious zealots, to rule you, then you're just opening the possibilities of tyranny and despotism that are rife. There's examples throughout history of how millions and millions of people get killed in crusades and marches and these, you know, anti-them and anti-us. So forgive me for the diatribe. We got about 8.5 minutes to go, but I hope this helps everybody understand what are primary source documents here and why we're really picking on the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers are insightful. They're you know, you can read the newspaper. And do you believe everything you read in the newspaper today? How about you, Sean? I don't. Okay.
That's a good one.
Okay, so the point is can you believe anything and everything? These men were not even under oath. As a matter of fact, if you could catch them for libel, you could actually, you know, fry these guys for libel. But in the debates, they were under oath. Big difference, right?
And I think that's a very big difference.
And during the convention, they were under obligation of a commission, which is why these men constantly brought up their commission and said, hey, we don't want to go too far, but we do understand we have to propose something, you know, that will actually fix the problems, because if not, then they're doomed. And they did the right thing, because the focus was to deal with the exigencies of the Union, to save the Union, and to maintain a Republican form of government. And what came out of that was a superior Republican form of government and an exemplar for all governments that were to be created in the land of liberty to follow that paradigm, where we actually have the checks and balances between representatives of the people and representatives of our government. Therefore, as we now can dive into, because I just started this off again, to the people of New York, Hamilton starts off with paragraph 2. Let us go ahead. Go ahead, Sean. Thank you.
Let us now return to the partition of the judiciary authority between different courts and their relations to each other. Quote, the judicial power of the United States is, by the plan of the convention, in parentheses, to be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish, end quote. Mm-hmm. That there ought to be one court of supreme and final jurisdiction is a proposition which is not likely to be contested.
Hold on, man.
The reason for...
Hold on.
Yeah, good, because right there...
That right there. Thank you. That right there, he is creating a maxim. Or an axiom,
right?
That, hey, there can only be one Supreme Court and final jurisdiction, when the fact is that the Constitution only gives them jurisdiction over those things arising under the Constitution, not ultimately all things that deal with law in the United States. There's a huge difference, folks. Marriage and common law, matters of common law, they have no jurisdiction over those things if it does not arise under the Constitution. And the only reason why common law cases can actually dwell up only if your rights are being violated. In other words, they can't just pull a common law case up into their review and then actually judge on it. What they would do if a common law case was violated, I'll give you a perfect example. If there was a controversy in a case of common law where the value of the controversy was greater than $20 and the state did not afford you, and you were tried without a trial by jury, you were thrown in front of a magistrate, you would have a right to appeal that and actually go to the Supreme Court and say, my rights were violated. And under the Seventh Amendment of the Constitution, the Supreme Court would have very tight jurisdiction, very tight. And they would basically pull that case up. They would review it and say, yea, verily, this case exceeded $20. And the Constitution, therefore, declares that in common law cases greater than $20, the right of trial by jury shall be enforced and shall be preserved. And in looking at the 14th Amendment, all privileges and immunities guaranteed to you as a citizen is now applied to the states. Therefore, the states fail to give this person their right of a trial by jury. Therefore, the case is then this would be a 15-minute administrative decision. Therefore, this case is remanded back to the state, where the state must give this trial, either this case is either acquitted or they try the person with a trial by jury. Now, technically, if it's a capital case, I believe, then they've really ruined it, because if that's the case, then I believe a capital case, you can't be, that would be double jeopardy. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Right. So getting it right is important, and the Supreme Court can actually come in when your rights are being violated and state the person's rights are violated. That's all they can do. It doesn't give them the ability to try and actually, adjudicate the entire case all over again as if it's a true appeal. The only thing that is being appealed is that the process was violated and the rights of an individual were violated. Then the Supreme Court stands up and says, yeah, they were violated. Do it right, state. Go back and either do it right or just let this man go. Period. There you go. Done. So that's an example. But right here he's saying that there ought to be one court of supreme and final jurisdiction is a proposition which is likely not to be contested. And of course, there was no contesting to this because nobody knew what it said, what he was saying here. This was literally just being tucked in. So that when Marshall finally shines light on this, he says, nobody can contest this. Here it is. Go ahead.
Reminds me of Genesis 3. How ironic, it's paragraph 3.
Okay. Yeah.
The reason for it had been assigned in another place and are too obvious to need repetition. The only question that seemed to have been raised concerning it is whether it ought to be a distinct body or a branch of the legislature. The same contradiction is observable in regard to this matter, which has been remarked in several other cases. The very men who object to the Senate as a court of impeachments on the ground of an improper intermixture of powers advocate, by implication at least, the propriety of vesting the ultimate decision of all causes in the whole or in a part of the legislative body.
Okay, so this is interesting, because what he says in the next third sentence, the only question that seems to have been raised concerning it is whether it ought to be a distinct body or a branch of the legislature. What is he surmising? Giving them legislative powers.
Yeah, this is very intricate wordplay.
Yes. Folks, this is where those men who understood the nuances of the law of the time, Hamilton was creating a tapestry of ways they could use to justify and to vindicate their ascension to power, their ascension to this new place in our government in creating a judiciary form of government. And he goes basically on and says, the very men who object to the Senate as a court of impeachments on the ground of an improper intermixture of powers advocate, by implication at least, the propriety of vesting the ultimate decisions of all cases in the whole or in the body of the legislative body. That is the Republican form of government, though. And so, just to be clear here, what we're looking at is a judgment of the Senate as a trial by jury, not an oligarchy of magistrates where you just have a couple, where you just have a very, very minority of people with power. you know, five people, three people, such as in your state. We'll be right back after this break.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as we kind of look, and what I was basically pointing out, is that when we really look at the impeachment process, there are two trials. And actually, it's not trials. These are grand jury trials. When you look at what the House does to determine whether charges need to be filed and whether a trial actually needs to occur, and when you look at that, that is the entire House of Representatives in basically the same form as a grand jury with subpoena power, being able to go and get the data. They have subpoena power to do this. This, when you look, that is not a court of judges. That is a grand jury of the people, the people's representatives, to demand, you know, the production of these documents, the production of this evidence, so forth and so on. And as they examine everything that they've called forth, and when they're all done calling forth everything and testimony and everything else, they determine that a crime has been committed. Therefore, the very first part of the impeachment was a grand jury indictment. Then it goes into a grand jury conviction, because now we go into a more tight body, you know, 100 men or 100 men and women in the Senate who try the president for the crimes and the evidence that was brought before them. And they choose whether that person is guilty or not. The problem I have with the impeachment process is the way that it falls down political lines. And what I mean by that is whether the party is willing to, you know, obviate and or obscure what the truth and the law is or what have you. When we had Bill Clinton basically impeached, he should have been removed based on the fact that he perjured himself, and based on the fact that that was deemed as an impeachable offense, he should have been removed. When we look at Trump, that was a completely different case. That was all partisan politics. There was no actual violation. It's just one party didn't like the other. And so that's why the Senate, I don't even think the Senate even moved for a trial at all. They basically just kind of, that ain't happening. So and throughout the history, I think that there needs to be a better way of doing this, because I think the case really needs to be proving, because to be honest with you, to go after a president over perjury, I mean, Nixon resigned for, you know, for his meddling and for the fact that he had and he lied. But he possessed evidence that proved the Watergate, and, you know, what happened with Watergate. He hid that. What Bill Clinton did was just, they're very similar. And Nixon stepped down. What should have happened was that Clinton should have been basically kicked out. That would have actually created Gore as the president, which would have given him a more substantial or more, help me out here. It would have given him the position of running as an incumbent in the 2000 election, where George Bush would not be challenging an unproven president. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Right, wrong,
none of it sounds good.
No, none of it sounds good, but right, wrong, or indifferent, the
right,
America was facing, and the decisions were purely partisan. Purely partisan. And so,
well, it was just like people talking about impeaching Joe Biden.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. It's better to ride it out.
Yeah, correct. Correct. Well, to be clear here, presidents, past presidents, can be impeached for their sins and atrocities. Joe Biden should be impeached. It's proven. Because a president maintains emoluments, the whole point of an impeachment is not to throw somebody in jail. It is to remove them from their station and emoluments. There is actually a past president station. They have a security trial, or not a security, they have a security detail of the Secret Service, and they have money coming to them, which under the original writing of the Constitution, when you were no longer president, you were gone. You got nothing. You had, you know, this notoriety. Hey, you used to be president, but that, you know, going to Starbucks, you'd still have to pay $5 or $10 now to get a cup of coffee. You weren't entitled to anything. Today, presidents are entitled, which means that they do have a station and they do have emoluments, which means that they are susceptible to the standards of impeachment. Impeachment, the whole process is to remove those. And when somebody has been proven to be bad, they don't deserve those. And so that is a way of actually removing. And to Obama, George W. Bush, Clinton, every past president, and Biden, they all deserve to be impeached and have all of their security details canceled for what they've done. All of them. And if Jimmy Carter was still alive, he would have to face it too. Because he did things that were absolutely atrocious. Anyway, so...
I agree, sir.
So let's move on to paragraph 4. Go ahead.
Paragraph 4. The arguments, or rather suggestions, upon which this charge is founded are to this effect. Quote, the authority of the proposed Supreme Court of the United States, which is to be a separate and independent body, will be superior to that of the legislature. The power of construing the laws according to the spirit of the Constitution will enable that court to mold them into whatever shape it may think proper, especially as its decision will not be in any manner subject to the revision or correction of the legislative body. This is as unprecedented as it is dangerous. In Britain, the judicial power, in the last resort, resides in the House of Lords, which is a branch of the legislature, and this part of the British government has been imitated in the state constitutions in general. The Parliament of Great Britain and the legislature of the several states can, at any time, rectify by law the exceptional decision of their respective courts, but the errors and usurpations of the Supreme Court of the United States will be uncontrollable and remedyless, end quote.
All right.
This,
so,
upon examination.
Go ahead. Keep going.
Sounds
going.
Like a prophecy.
Yes. Yeah, but everything he's saying in here, quote, the authority of the proposed Supreme Court of the United States, which is to be a supreme and independent body, will be superior to that of the legislature. The power of the construing laws according to the spirit of the Constitution will enable that court to mold them in whatever shape it may think proper, especially as to its decisions will not be in any manner subject to revision correction of that legislative body. This is an unprecedented as it is dangerous. In Britain, the judicial power in the last resort resides the House of Lords, which is a branch of the legislature and is part of Britain. Right. And he goes on and says the British government has been imitated in the state constitutions in general. The Parliament of Great Britain. So the quote ends just down here. The Parliament of Great Britain and the legislatures of the several states can at any time rectify by law the exceptional decisions of their respective courts. But the errors and usurpations of the Supreme Court of the United States will be uncontrollable and redeemless. OK. Or
who is he quoting there?
So he's, you know, the arguments are rather suggestions upon which is, which this charge is founded are to this effect, and that's where he makes this quote. And right. So whoever's making this quote, based on everything he's saying, is absolutely true. In other words, this, upon examination, will be found to be made up altogether of false reasoning upon misconceived fact. So how does he prove this wrong? So go ahead on five. Let's look at how he's going to throw out the facts here, that this is all misconceived. So let's see how he
right.
does
well,
that.
What I was trying to get at is, where did he get this part that he quoted, that you're saying that the arguments are to this effect? The arguments of who? Because it seems like he's directly reflecting on what someone else said, and this is what they said, that if
yes.
they do the Supreme Court.
And in all honesty, the way the Federalist Papers were, they never cited, because the Anti-Federalist was Brutus. Right. So when you look, I think there were a few different pseudonyms, but Brutus was the common. And so I don't think they ever used the citation that Brutus said this or Cicero said that or what have you. So go ahead. Because okay, what we want to do is we want to see how he basically refutes this, because a really bad job in refuting this actually supports it.
In the first place, there is not a syllable in the plan under consideration which directly empowers the national courts to construe the laws according to the spirit of the Constitution, or which gives them any greater latitude in this respect that may be claimed by the courts of every state. I admit, however, that the Constitution ought to be the standard of construction for the laws, and that wherever there is an evident opposition, the laws ought to give place to the Constitution. But this doctrine is not deducible from any circumstance peculiar to the plan or the convention, but from the general theory of a limited constitution, and as far as it is true, is equally applicable to most, if not all, of the state governments. There can be no objection, therefore, on this account, to the federal judicature, which will not lie against the local judicatures in general, and which will not serve to condemn every constitution that attempts to set bounds to legislative discretion.
So, how well did he refute that so far?
He didn't.
He didn't. And he actually says, I think he uses the word I admit. However, that the Constitution ought to be the standard of the construction for the laws, and that whatever there is an evident opposition, the laws ought to give place to the Constitution. Okay, so let's keep going to see how he, in this, maybe supports this idea that there's no way the court has this kind of ultimate control.
But perhaps the force of the objection may be thought to consist in the particular organization of the Supreme Court, in its being composed of a distinct body of magistrates instead of being one of the branches of the legislature, as in the government of Great Britain and in that of the state. To insist upon this point, the authors of the objection must renounce the meaning they have labored to annex to the celebrated maxim, requiring a separation of the departments of power.
Okay, so let me break in here. The very first sentence jumps out, because he makes a reference, and I have said this before. Remember when we went through the appointment of the delegates going to the Constitutional Convention, how I highlighted that certain states' legislatures considered themselves the Supreme Court of the state.
Correct.
The Great Council of the state, what have you. Right here at the very beginning of the first sentence, he says, but perhaps the force of the objection may be thought to consist in the particular organization of the Supreme Court, in its being composed of a distinct body of magistrates, instead of being one of the branches of the legislature, as in the government of Britain and of that of the state. So in other words, many of the states already considered, and when you look at Continental Congress, it was the judiciary.
Was New York structured that way?
I believe so. I believe many of the states at that point did not have standalone judiciaries. that there were so many people that were in law and in government that it was kind of, you know, an ad hoc thing. They had courts for common law purposes, but for the big, you know, commerce, those types of things, that, you know, the state decided how they wanted to move forward, whether they would appoint it to a circuit judge that was traveling around or pull together, you know, a large tribunal. It was just like with the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation left it up to Continental Congress to decide how each case would be adjudicated case by case and who would adjudicate it. Okay, so back to where you were, it shall, go ahead. You read the second sentence. Go ahead and start off with, it shall nevertheless.
It shall nevertheless be conceded to them agreeable to the interpretation given to that maxim in the course of these papers, that it is not violated by vesting the ultimate power of judging in a part of the legislative body. But though this be not an absolute violation of that excellent rule, yet it verges so nearly upon it, as on this account alone to be less eligible than the mode preferred by the convention. From a body which had even a partial agency in passing bad laws, we could rarely expect a disposition to temper and moderate them in the application. The same spirit which had operated in making them would be too apt in interpreting them. Still less could it be expected that men who had infringed the Constitution in the character of legislators would be disposed to repair the breach in the character of judges. Nor is this all. Every reason which recommends the tenure of good behavior for judicial offices militates against placing the judiciary power in the last resort in a body composed of men chosen for a limited period. There is an absurdity in referring the determination of causes, in the first instance, to judges of permanent standing, in the last, to those of a temporary immutable constitution. And there is a still greater absurdity in subjecting the decisions of men selected for their knowledge of the laws, acquired by a long and laborious study, to the revision and control of men who, for one of the same advantage, cannot but be deficient in that knowledge. The members of the legislature will rarely be chosen with a view to those qualifications which fit men for the stations of judges. And as, on this account, there will be great reason to apprehend all the ill consequences of defective information, so, on account of the natural propensity of such bodies to party divisions, there will be no less reason to fear that the pestilential breath of faction may poison the fountains of justice. The habit of being continually marshaled on opposite sides will be too apt to stifle the voice both of the law and of equity. That's some fancy words right there. I like that phrase.
The habit of being continually marshaled on opposite sides?
Well, the whole thing, the pestilential breath of faction may poison the fountains of justice.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's what factions do. And as a matter of fact,
that's what they do.
Interestingly enough, they don't start out that way. Because when you looked at, well, let me just say, one faction, it's usually the first faction that wants to get away from what you've got. And technically what ended up happening was that what became the Federalists. Because the Federalists basically, on what this creature, Hamilton, was instantly implicating, that implied powers existed within the Constitution, he took the Federalists and perverted them. Oh, well, that's how it was decided. That's how it was defined. Madison argued and proved otherwise. He proved otherwise. And these men still allowed their avarice and, you know, the opportunities that would be arising from the corruption itself to basically throw the truth under the bus and rule for implied powers, unconstitutional government. Out the gate, 1792, Hamilton proved that these men could be bought. And in 1793, when Hamilton was being tried by the House of Representatives for, you know, his ethics and what have you. This is the first time, I think, in history, and very seldom has there been a point in time in history where a director under the executive, or I should say a secretary, was actually charged with improprieties, facing the potential, you know, maybe the verdict of, I'll just say treason. Hamilton was facing the potential of being hanged. And there's no doubt in my mind, Washington, who loved Hamilton like his own son, was not happy. Was basically his biases had already been, you know, polluted. And this is one of the reasons why why Washington, in his farewell address, his whole farewell address was really dedicated towards the evil of factions and how divisive they are and how they're going to destroy this nation. Because he looked at what Madison was doing was a faction, when Madison was actually trying to hold Hamilton accountable to the law. This wasn't partisan. This was accountable to the law, and Hamilton's friends, his allies, his Federalists in Congress, said, we got to protect ourselves because we've got a good thing going with this Hamilton guy. Look at the money and look at the opportunity that we're getting from the goose that lays our golden egg. And it took a few years to basically finally get to a point where Madison and Jefferson could prove that, you know, tyranny was around the corner with the Alien Sedition Act. So they moved forward with their resolutions and ultimately their coup against this interpretation, this ill interpretation of the Constitution that Hamilton was purporting. So anyway, interestingly enough, let's go ahead and dive into, I do like that those last two sentences, though. You're right. That right there basically lays out, you know, what we're looking at today, the pestilence breath of factions. So, okay, so number seven. Hold on here. There was one word that jumped out up above. And it is from a body which had been a partial agency in passing in bad laws, we could rarely expect a disposition to temper and moderate them in the application. The same spirit which had operated in making them would be too apt in interpreting them. So he's using this concept of interpreting the law, that we have to interpret. And that, you know, that's just a part of the process. They would interpret, or the court would interpret. Hey, it's all up to interpretation when it's not. The Constitution was clear. There is no interpretation. It is law and fact. What does the law say, and what are the facts? How was that law defined? If you can interpret and redefine it, then now you have a problem. But see, Madison, that's why he read from the ratification debates in the very beginning. And we've proven this in these source documents we've provided you. He literally read the ratification debates, I think, during the Assumption Act. It was during the Bank Act. He read the debates of the Carolinas, Virginia, and I think four states altogether, of how the Constitution clearly laid out that there are no such thing as implied powers. And they ignored it. And then the court. This is what happens when you put into station people that are not committed to compliance to the Constitution. Are we doomed because we have lower character today? I don't think so. I just think that at that point in time, these men didn't see the evil that they were putting into motion. We're now harvesting a magnitude of evil that is beyond the pale. Now, paragraph 7. Thank you.
Yes, sir. These considerations teach us to applaud the wisdom of those states who have committed the judicial power in the last resort, not to a part of the legislature, but to distinct and independent bodies of men. Contrary to the supposition of those who have represented the plan of the convention, in this respect, as novel and unprecedented. It is but a copy of the constitutions of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, and the preference which has been given to those models is highly to be commended.
Okay, so those are the states, and if you notice, do you see New York in there? Other words, New York was one of those states that the legislature controlled the judiciary functions. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 out of 13. So the subtraction of the four states left, New York being one of them, right? Connecticut being another one. And I could do possible deductions. Rhode Island is another one because they were kind of, well, they're not in alphabetical order. But anyway, the point is that this speaks to, as a matter of fact, folks, you hear me say this all the time, and I'm here to tell you that this speaks to how different the state governments were, okay? In other words, everybody knew that not one state legislature, not one state government was similar to any others. There was these nuances, and in this particular case regarding the judiciary, if we went down, because I already kind of captured this, in my article on the Federalist Papers, that, you know, how many states didn't have an executive and which states they were. I identified how the formation and the types of governments that existed in the all 13 states at the time of the Constitution. Now, there's this theory out there, and there's this lie that all of the states had to change their form of government to ratify the Constitution. What? Now, we've gone through I've gone through all these documents. I have no idea where this lie is coming from, but there is no source document that actually even says or proves that. None. As a matter of fact, Massachusetts didn't really start moving towards this open religion, free market, and so forth until 1830, when they finally disbanded the control of the Puritan church, or I should say the church, over government. They kind of started separating those controls. And how did they start? They started allowing the Jews to openly practice in Massachusetts in 1830 or 1833. Wow. So you're telling me that all the states, just like that, were magically transformed, just like the Transformer movies for kids. You know, these kids actually are helping everybody believe this lie that all the states were transformed, and they weren't. Okay, so this right here supports this. This is another document or another, stage here where Hamilton is exposing the fact how all of the states were literally laid out in these different configurations. So I apologize. We were going to get further forward in this, but my monologue at the very beginning kind of went long, but hopefully the understanding of what primary source documents are, interpretation, all of these types of things, it's critical, folks. There are standards of laws, and this is all applied. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.